It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Welcome, I'm Larry Mantle, joined this week by critics Amy Nicholson, film writer for The Guardian and host of the podcast The Canon and Unspooled, Peter Rayner, Christian Science Monitor film critic, and Tim Cogshell, film critic for Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com. Up first, Spike Lee's new movie, Black Klansman, based on the book by Ron Stallworth. It stars John David Washington, a native Angeleno, Adam Driver, and Topher Grace. It's the true story of Stallworth, who was a police officer, his infiltration of the Colorado Springs chapter of the KKK in the early 1970s with the help of his Jewish partner.
Doesn't that hatred you've been hearing the Klan say, doesn't that piss you off?
Of course it does.
Then why are you acting like you ain't got skin in the game, brother?
Rookie, that's my business.
It's our business.
Let me start with you, Tim. What'd you think of Black Klansman?
At once funny, very, very, very funny, thrilling, and ultimately deeply moving and dramatic movie. A Spike Lee joint composed in the classic sort of Spike Lee way, right? This film has much to do with the earliest films of Spike Lee. So we're talking about She's Gotta Have It and School Days and Do the Right Thing, of course. A film composed almost completely in masters. He cuts, but very often when something very, very important is going on, someone is making a speech, he holds that frame in a single shot, perhaps creeping in just a little bit to let it weigh on you the way it does. Yet a funny, 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 funny movie. So it tells the story, a true story, which I think is the reason why the film is so focused, because this story happened. Most of it, in the way that it happened. So Spike does not do that thing that he sometimes will do where he wanders off on tangents here and there. No, here he stays on point, and he manages to tell the story as sharply and as pointedly as it can be told and still be funny and thrilling and deeply moving.
What about the music? Terrence Blanchard often does his scores. He's back this time.
Oh, yeah, and it's a score that I think is Oscar-worthy. Because as is the point of Terrence Blanchard, it's a note, it's a tone, it's a mood that he establishes. There are several motifs in this film that involve montages, and that Terrence Blanchard score just floats beneath.
He's
those
one of
montages.
My favorites. I'm glad to hear that. Amy, what'd you think?
Yeah, I was surprised when I left the movie to realize that the most outlandish bits, the parts that I was rolling my eyes at, like, oh come on, were true. That really floored me. There's some coincidences in there that I was like, no way, Spike. Now you're taking it too far. Oh, I'm an idiot. That actually did happen. I like this film slightly less. I'm a bigger fan of his last film, Chirac, which I just thought was so imaginative and funny and sharp. That was the one that was the version of the Trojan women, like having a...
Lysistrata.
Yeah. Yes. This one I thought had some funny bits. I think to balance out those masterful shots that Tim was talking about, there's other parts I thought were just so sort of choppily and weirdly edited. Somebody walks into a room and there's like eight cuts of them walking from a different angle. And I was sort of scrambled a bit by that. Like, what is happening here? Like, I think the film is great and I'm glad that it exists right now. It feels sort of like RTing a really perfect meme is how I felt, because there's a lot of quotes and they're taken from Trump and from our leaders. There's a lot of dialogue in here that is just taken from
previous Spike Lee films, actually. He's at
he
a point
himself,
now where he can quote himself, and it's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. He tells us to wake up, as he did years ago in School Days. Got it gone. That's straight out of Do the Right Thing. You know, it's 35 years of consideration of these things, I think, gives him the right to actually start, you know, pointing out that many of the things that he's been talking about for that long are still problematic.
Peter, what did you think of Black Klansman?
I wasn't quite as high on it as you guys. I do think it's one of his better movies, for a while, because it is more contained and you know, doesn't go all over the place like a lot of his films tend to do. I think obviously what he's trying to do here is create a parallel between then and now, and saying that basically, you know, then is now. And, you know, there are clips of, you know, Topher Grace plays the Grand Wizard, David Duke in this film. And then at the end, you see actual clips of David Duke today. You see Trump, you see the Charlottesville riots in the end, you know, the tiki torching alt-right guys. That's all, you know, in the film at the end. So clearly, the point of this movie, the political point of this movie is that things haven't really moved very far since the 70s when this story takes place. And I think, you know, it's obviously a powerful point. Those clips would be powerful even without this movie. You know, they're just it's an outrage that exists independent of what Spike Lee does with it. And he loads a lot of heavy baggage onto what is often kind of, you know, review sketch material that would work well as a kind of Saturday Night Live sketch or one of Jordan Peele's, comedy sketches.
A producer
as well.
Of the film, interesting.
Yeah, who's a producer, who was originally going to direct it, I think, until Get Out was such a huge hit that he couldn't do it for time reasons and passed it along to Spike Lee, who's a very good choice for this material. But I think that there's sort of a disconnect in some ways between the power of what he's trying to do in this film politically and the drama itself, which is entertaining, but, you know, is carrying a lot of heavy baggage, maybe too heavy for the way the story is played out. And also, he has a tendency in all of his films, less so in this, but still, to have his characters be mouthpieces, you know, sort of, you know, political mouthpieces, preaching. And I think that tends to sort of make things go wooden whenever that happens.
Spike Lee films are didactic. Surely they are. To me, it's almost always dependent, though, on the ability of the actor to speak the words. So if you're watching Malcolm X and Denzel Washington, actual Denzel Washington, you know, as opposed to John David, is giving one of those speeches that Malcolm gives. Didactic, yes. Powerful, yes. Captivating, absolutely. Here, I think John David approaches that. He's very, very good. People talk about how he sounds a lot like Denzel, and he does. If you close your eyes, you think it's Denzel speaking. The tone and timbre and that pattern. He looks like his mom, though. I just want to point out, he looks just like his mom, who's also kind of famous. And so in this movie, I feel like most of those speeches, Adam Driver, too, strong, strong performance by Adam Driver. He's just so good in this movie. I think that they can pull it
Laura
off.
Laura Herring.
Good.
Yeah, Pauletta Washington is his mom. Black Klansman is the film. It's rated R, starring John David Washington, Adam Driver, and Topher Grace. Spike Lee directed. He's one of the four screenwriters of the film. And the real Ron Stallworth is going to be joining us on Air Talk later this month to talk about his story. So we hope you'll tune in. That's going to be on August 20th. Ron Stallworth himself will be with us right here on 89.3. Next, The Meg, an action thriller starring, who else? Jason Statham, along with Bing Bing Lee and Rainn Wilson. John Turteltaub is the director. It's the story of a group of scientists who find a massive prehistoric being once thought extinct living beneath the sea.
What you people discovered is bigger than we ever thought possible.
How big is that thing?
It was the largest shark that ever existed.
A living fossil.
The Meg, Amy?
I should preface everything I'm about to say with the fact that I love a big bad shark movie. I love Jaws 3. I will stand up for Jaws 4. I thought The Meg was...
You do love a big...
Sharknado?
I've got my lines, and The Meg is on the other side of the line. This is a bad, bad, big shark movie.
Ooh.
It is. And it's... the problem with this film is that, as you can even tell from that clip, it takes itself so seriously, this premise of finding a shark. It's very scientific. The setup is this group of explorers funded by a billionaire, played by Rainn Wilson, and I do love an evil billionaire.
Is there any other kind in the movies?
There's not. Is there any other kind in reality?
That is kind of that's casting against type, though, Rainn Wilson in that role. Yeah.
Well, he does it in that sort of San Francisco tech bro, shaggy hair type.
Okay. All right.
So, which I think those are the billionaires we got to look out for right now. They go into the Mariana Trench. There's a theory that if you go underneath this one where you think the floor is, there's actually a whole second tropical ocean. It's a giant proposition. They managed to pull it off in like 5 seconds, and it's amazing. But then this giant shark shows up, and it takes a very long time for this movie to get fun. I would say it doesn't get fun until the third act when tourists are in danger, which is about all I want to say about that spoilery-wise.
You sadist, you thought that was fun? The little puppy is getting chased by the shark?
That puppy is the star.
Yeah, which is one of a million nods to earlier better movies like Jaws.
There's even the banana boat from Jaws 4, which maybe is it only amuses me.
You know, I wanted to enjoy this movie more than I did because I really enjoy, you know, big bad movies, you know, with all sorts of cliches and scenes, you know, where you hear knocking on the, you know, the sub walls and you go, oh no, you know, that kind of thing. But it's pretty clunky the way it's done. And also the Meg, the giant shark, is what, 70 feet long or something? You barely ever see the thing. Probably a good thing because it probably looks so phony. But it's not very scary because it's just this big, you know, mollusk encrusted thing that sort of, you know, barrels through the water. And it really makes you appreciate Jaws.
Badly realized CGI. They would have been better off with that broken shark that Spielberg was dealing with. But at least it was real. And, you know, they had to have guys down there flopping it around.
Yeah.
But you bought it. This movie is built from a whole. I mean, this movie is built from stuff. The guy's name is Jonas. That's the Bible. I mean, I know it's a whale in the Bible, but you know, nevertheless, the lead character's name is Jonas. And you work your way.
At least it's not Ahab.
Yeah. You know, and there's a little bit of John Huston's Moby Dick in this movie with Orson Welles. So it's just building itself from all of these other movies, but it's just not having enough fun with it. You know, I've never seen one of those Sharknado movies, but people tell me they're really outlandish.
It's got quite a following.
It's got quite a following, and it seems to me that if you're going to do one of these, you got to take your cue from that, right? I mean, am I wrong, right? You're going to be a big, dumb shark movie. What are the biggest, dumbest shark movies? The Sharknado movies. You got to start there and work your way forward.
Yeah, I'm not a shark movie completist. So
The Meg is the action horror film Jason Statham stars. It's rated PG-13 in wide release. The romantic drama The Miseducation of Cameron Post stars Chloe Grace Moretz, directed by Desiree Akhavan, who also co-wrote the screenplay. The Miseducation of Cameron Post, about a teenage girl forced into gay conversion therapy by her conservative guardians.
The first step is for you to stop thinking of yourself as a homosexual.
I don't think of myself as a homosexual. I don't really think of myself as anything.
The Miseducation of Cameron Post, Peter?
I like this film. I think it's a small-scale, powerful movie, very well acted, about a strong subject. It's set in 1993. It's based, I guess, I gather, on a young adult novel. And the gay conversion therapy camp called God's Promise is a very creepy place because everybody is supposedly, you know, looking for happiness, and yet there's a tremendous amount of unhappiness and turmoil and all sorts of things are going on underneath this. And the Chloe Moretz, Grace Moretz character is really, you know, she was caught making out with her girlfriend, and so she was sent to this camp. And she doesn't entirely identify with being gay, but she sort of feels that she doesn't belong there in any event. And she teams up with these two other, disconsolate types who don't want to be in the camp either, played very well by Forrest Goodluck and Sasha Lane. And it's surprisingly upbeat given the subject matter, because it's about finding yourself in the midst of all of this extreme exertion to change these people from who they are. Jennifer Ely, who's the sort of the chief big nurse of the camp, is quite good in particular. But the wail that comes through in this movie from Moretz is, you know, how is programming people to hate themselves, not a form of torture, really, and I think that's a very important message that comes through in this film.
Amy,
yeah, this is a really great showcase for Chloe Grace Moretz, you know, who became famous with Hit Girl in the Kick-Ass series. She's really great in this. It just sort of lets her shine. I feel like it was the Chloe Moretz show. It's a really likable film, so likable that it won, I think, the Sundance Grand Jury Prize in the drama section this year. I didn't find the most compelling emotional hook to carry it through all the way for me. But what I liked in Desiree's eye is just how she captures the shifting alliances of the different teenagers in here. Who's your friend today? Who's your friend tomorrow? Sasha Lane and Forrest Goodluck, who Peter pointed out, people know Sasha from American Honey. Forrest Goodluck was the kid in The Revenant. There's times where they don't trust her, and I enjoy that. They're trying to figure out who's the rat.
Movie is The Miseducation of Cameron Post. It's unrated at Lemley's Playhouse Pasadena, the ArcLight Hollywood, and at Irvine Edwards Town Center, Edwards University. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. A lot more movies to talk about, and we'll hear from Oscar-winning screenwriter Robert Towne of Chinatown fame back in a minute. This is Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Let me reintroduce our critics. Delighted to have with us Tim Cogshell, Peter Rayner, and Amy Nicholson. Next up, Dog Days, a comedy drama starring Vanessa Hudgens, Nina Dobrev, and Eva Longoria. It's directed by Ken Marino and written by Alyssa Matsuedo and Erica Oyama. Amy, what'd you think of Dog Days?
Yeah, you know, we have this trend of movies like Valentine's Day and New Year's Day where it's a bunch of interconnected stories structured around a holiday. I guess here dogs are the holiday. Dogs are the structure of this giant movie with a bunch of stars. You know, there's a bunch of subplots kind of here about how just dogs are the central part of our life compared to this movie. I mean, I'm a cat person, so also preface.
So you're biased coming into this.
There's not a single cat in this movie. But we have, you know, a barista who's a little lost in life who adopts a chihuahua to get closer to a hunky vet across the street. You have the newscaster who's dealing with a breakup by putting all of her negative emotions on her dog and taking her dog to therapy. There are dogs that are lost. There are dogs that are found. There are dogs in every single frame of this movie. And yes, there is a cover of Who Let the Dogs Out. This movie is obviously just trying to be the cutest that it possibly can. And there's, I spent half of the movie rolling my eyes, and then twice I cried. So it's that kind of a movie.
Boy, you're going to go nuts when the panda movie comes out.
Oh, I hate pandas, so that's fine.
Yeah, you hate pandas?
That's right. You're the only person who hates pandas. I forgot about it. Tim?
We'll have to do a show on that.
I got panda issues, too. You know, this movie is just so awfully, awfully, awfully cute. Awfully cute. And this just the thing of it is, it's just too much. All these couples. So you have the newscaster thing and their dogs, right? And then you have this guy who's in this band and has this sister, and she's all upset because she just had a baby and that dog. Then you've got this old man and the pizza boy, and he accidentally lets that dog out, and it turns out the old guy's a widow and her dog. It's just this all too much. It's too much. Lift any three of these stories out, squeeze it all together, and it does another thing that bugs me. All right, this big scene is supposed to be at Griffith Park. It's like downtown, man. It's downtown. I'm like, come on, guys. I mean, that's just
a, Wait, I'm sorry. That's where your plausibility issues came into play, and not the fact that there is a giant superstar celebrity dog fundraiser that happens to be on the news all night?
That's ridiculous. But, you know.
Dog Days rated PG in wide release. Elizabeth Harvest, a thriller starring Abby Lee and Kieran Hines, written and directed by Sebastian Gutierrez. Peter, what'd you think of Elizabeth Harvest?
I liked this for a while. I really liked the film Ex Machina, and this draws quite a bit on that. But it does have a life of its own. It also draws on a lot of De Palma movies with the split-screen horror stuff. You know, it's a very derivative movie. But it does have a certain creepy fascination for a while. You've got this billionaire played by Kieran Hines, of course, evil, who brings back his bride to this palatial place in Nowheresville where he lives and says, you can have the run of anything in this place that you want except this one room. Don't go in that room. Guess what happens, folks? But the thing is, I mean, without giving too much away, about 20 minutes into the movie, it essentially seems to start over entirely. And I had to check my VCR to see what is something weird going on, because it seems like the film is starting all over again, you know. But that's the premise of the film, and it gets a little more convoluted and not quite, you know, sensical after that. So, you know, it has its moments, but ultimately I thought it kind of dissipated into, you know, weirdo land.
Now, wait, you just took us back in time, your VCR. You meant your DVD player,
yeah,
no doubt.
Well, I had to do dial-up in order to get it, by the way.
Amy?
Yeah, I liked this, too, more than I expected. I mean, it's working with just the oldest things we've got in the book. Beauty and the Beast, giant banquets of endless desserts, this utter luxurious surreality, you know, Jane Eyre, Bluebeard. We're working with all of the classics here. What I liked about it, I think in particular, is that the woman here at the Star, Abby Lee, I'm a big Abby Lee fan as I'm watching her get giant parts. She's starting to. Abby Lee, for people who saw Neon Demon, she was the best model in Neon Demon. She was one of the girls in the background of Mad Max Fury Road. She's a real-life model. I think she's got a terrific presence, and I could stare at her all day. So could the camera. She's naked a lot. But I think there's a voice here. This is a movie that I liked. I'm glad I got to keep an eye on. And this is a filmmaker I want to keep an eye on. And it's an actress I think everybody should be watching.
Elizabeth Harvest is the thriller. You can see it at the Arena Cine Lounge Sunset in Hollywood. It's rated R. Slender Man, a horror film starring Joey King. It's directed by Sylvain White. David Burke is the screenwriter. Amy?
So Slender Man is a made-up monster that we all know when he got made up on the internet in 2009. He is basically Jack Skellington with, like, squid arms and no face. And somehow that turns out to be even less scary than you would think it would be. But he's become this viral phenomenon, and he has caused real-life damage before this movie even comes out. You know, a young girl burned her house down. Another girl was terrified of him and stabbed her mother. And then, famously, two 12-year-old girls stabbed their 12-year-old friend nearly to death, and they are still in mental hospitals and will be for, I think, 40 years. So I have conflicted feelings about this movie existing and promoting the Slender Man myth even more. That said, it's also just terrible. It's very, very bad. It's a movie that is not scary at all. In this world, Slender Man is a viral phenomenon here. There are four teenage girls. They watch a video about it. And then he starts to haunt them. And his form of haunting is basically you're in your house. You hear crackling logs. Your cell phone goes on the fritz. And this happens over and over and over.
And your VCR
and
stops.
Over and over. Peter's VCR stops somewhere over here. And there's really no point. There's no concept of what Slender Man is and what he really does except take you, I guess. And I'm happy to see the young actress Joey King in here. I think Joey King is a really great, young, fun actress. But I thought this movie just was such a letdown because you really have a chance to get into female friendship. You know, the real Slender Man murder, the attempted murder, was all about a woman, a young girl casting a spell on her other young girl friend, this shared delusion. And there's a really good opening to get into delusion as these four girls start to wonder if what they're seeing is real, as their friendships shift alliances. And it touches on it, but it really doesn't go into it. And I think that's the biggest waste in this film.
Slender Man, horror film in wide release. It's rated PG-13. The Captain, a German historical drama starring Max Hubacher. It's written and directed by Robert Schwenke. Peter?
Yeah, Schwenke has been working in Hollywood quite a bit, even though he's German. He did the movie Red and some of the Divergent films. This is sort of the week for me to like the first 20 minutes of movies, because I think the first 20
minutes...
Because
you're watching my VCR. Then the tape jams.
Right, in 20 minutes of this movie, it repeats itself. What the hell's going on? It's actually, this movie is repetitive, but not in that way. The premise is fascinating. This sort of, you know, a baby-faced deserter from, the German army, the final days of World War II, finds an abandoned military car complete with a uniform and medals of a captain. So he impersonates the captain, assembles this ragtag group of followers, most of whom are, you know, deserters, any of themselves, ends up in a German prison camp where the deserters are being held, and then proceeds to order them all executed at various times. It's shot in sort of handsome black and white. It's very well made. The premise is fascinating. You know, how does an ordinary guy, assuming the trappings of you know, impersonation, become a monster? And I think it's a metaphor for Nazism, et cetera, et cetera. But it goes out of control in the second half when he starts executing people. And you don't really get into the psychology of this character. And it seems to me if you're going to make a movie about how someone goes from A to Z, you ought to at least have, you know, MNLOP, you know, something in the middle there to show you a little bit more of the psychological progress.
The Captain, German historical drama written and directed by Robert Schwenke. Max Hubacher is the star. It's unrated, and you can see it at the New Art Theater in West Los Angeles. The Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society, a British historical drama. Lily James, Glenn Powell star. Mike Newell is the director, and the screenwriters Don Roos, Kevin Hood, and Thomas Bazooka. What'd you think, Amy?
Yeah, this is your Netflix rom-com to make a giant pot of tea and just cozy in. It's a historical rom-com about a woman in London who's a writer. The World War II has just ended, and she gets a letter from a person who lives on the island of Guernsey. And, you know, Guernsey, as backdrop, is a British island that's in between England and France. And during the war, it was occupied by Nazis. And while we picture the Londoners of World War II having a hard time with the bombing, these people were having it maybe worse and not feeling like they were heard, not feeling like anybody paid attention to them. So she shows up on their island because she heard they had a book club during the war. They don't want to talk about it. And it's basically her just figuring out why. There's a touch of a love triangle. She's engaged to Glenn Powell back at home. He's an American soldier. He's very rich. Glenn Powell from Set It Up. So Netflix is just really doubling down on the romantic comedies with Glenn Powell business. She also falls in love with a hunky pig farmer. It's just very...
Is there any other kind?
No, I think they are all hunky. You're correct. So it's just a cozy, comfortable, slightly long film. Likeable. It's just likeable.
The Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society is streaming on Netflix. It's unrated. The Norwegian drama Gavagi is directed by Rob Tregenza. It's written by Kirk Jeltsin and Rob Tregenza. Peter, what'd you think?
Incredibly pretentious. Gavagi is a term that was created by the Harvard philosophy professor Quine, W.V. Quine, to indicate something that is the difficulty of translating from one language or culture to another. There's a German guy in this film wanders into Norway to, it turns out, he's translating a Norwegian poet into Chinese because his late wife was Chinese and admired this poet. He hooks up with this minivan driver and they sort of bond. But this is not a Buddy Bond movie, even though the minivan driver looks and acts weirdly like Jack Black, sort of a Norwegian Jack Black. Mm. But there's only 12 setups in this entire movie. It's very, very long takes, very pretentious, very arty. There is a sense of grief that does come through in the film, but I think this is really only for extreme art house fanatics.
All right. Gavagi is the Norwegian drama. The film is unrated. I did want to quickly ask each of you, only have a couple minutes here before our break, what you think of the Academy in a tweet a couple of days ago announcing a new category for popular film, but not saying how those films would be considered. Tim, what do you think?
Better to say nothing than to announce something incomplete. The very notion of popular film, already problematic. To not even mention what it actually means, that makes it doubly problematic, because we can only think bad things about it. Perhaps if they had crafted a complete statement, they might have convinced me.
Amy, what do you think?
Yeah, the same thing. What is popular? I mean, is it going to be based on box office grosses? Because we've had, Titanic won an Oscar. We're fine with this category. And if it's based on box office grosses, if you make a good indie film that is now going to be quote-unquote unpopular, I guess, if it doesn't cross that line. Are you hoping you don't make more than, say, $60 million?
Well, and Get Out and Dunkirk made a lot of money, and they were Oscar nominated.
This is the most outrageous. This is the worst corporate decision since, New Coke. really, it's – and also, I mean, in addition to what everybody's saying about how stupid it is and how it's not even defined, I mean, I find it personally an affront as a critic and as an audience member. Since when are popular movies – somehow separated out from award-winning movies? The Godfather was a very popular movie. It's an affront. So you're going to have a category of popular, Transformer movies are going to win that just because they made a lot of money, but they don't qualify for movies that actually were good?
Yeah, it makes popular movies good again.
How this came about, I have no idea.
And the strangest way it was announced, there wasn't even a formal press release. There was, again, just sort of a tweet with this sort of incomplete idea. All right, well, you're going to be hearing a lot more about that proposal coming up in the weeks to come on Film Week. We'll continue. Robert Towne, Oscar-winning screenwriter of Chinatown, joins us next. It's Film Week on KPCC. Hi, you're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. And just this past Saturday, the theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles, it was our latest Film Week screening series, and we presented the classic from 1974, Chinatown, a dramatization, of course, of California's water and land wars. And after the screening, I had the honor of talking with Robert Towne, the Academy Award-winning screenwriter of Chinatown, writer of other acclaimed screenplays, and our Film Week critic, Claudia Puig, who's also president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association. First thing I asked Robert Towne was how he felt watching the film that he'd been involved with more than 40 years ago on a big screen in front of a capacity crowd of 1,600 filmgoers.
Less pressure than the first time I saw it. I mean, the jury's sort of been out on it. It was so scary the first time that I saw it.
What was your biggest fear? What did you think might be the audience reaction?
I had no idea. Up until the very end, we thought it was a disaster. Roman, at the time, was going off to Spoleto to do an opera. Left it to me and Evans.
Robert Evans, the head of Paramount.
Yes, to do the score. As you know, I mean, the first score that was done for the movie, it was sort of like Bad Schoenberg. Jerry Goldsmith, we called in, and he came and had to do the score in about 10 days.
One of the most acclaimed scores done in 10 days. I want to ask you about putting this together and where the idea came from, but Claudia, I want to ask you first. This is on every top film list of all time, many of them in the top 10, at least in the top 20 on virtually every list. What in your mind of all the terrific elements of the film makes it stand out as one of the all-time greats?
It's hard to pick out. You know, how there's so many things. The script is perfect. It's dramatic when it needs to be. It's funny when it needs to be. That balance, the dark humor, the gallows humor really stands out to me. The way it's shot, the meticulous way that Roman Polanski, you know, all the details, so
the
many wonderful
of
details.
Some of those scenes.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. And then, of course, the acting. And, you know, Nicholson, Dunaway, Houston, I mean, they're all so perfect. And the way it conjures up a sense of L.A., I really feel like I'm watching L.A. in 1930. I sort of forget that this was made in 1974. It's so iconic. This is like the fourth time I've seen it, and I get enraptured and caught up every time, and I marvel at the dialogue.
Yeah, it's so rich. Robert, where did the idea for the film come? Had you wanted to specifically write an L.A. noir story? Was that the idea that led to Chinatown, or did it come from some other concept?
It really started, as these things do, it really started because we couldn't get the last detail made because of the language.
One of the most profane movies when it finally did come out.
Yeah.
So you couldn't get the last detail made.
This
jumped
in that way.
This jumped ahead.
That way, yeah.
But is this an idea that you'd had in your head for this story for some time?
No. Well, look, Larry, I may have had the idea in my head, but I didn't know that I had the idea in my head.
I
mean,
yeah,
that would be a more reasonable way to say it, you know. It was the culmination and the combination of a lot of things that I was thinking about without realizing that I was thinking about it.
And you're close to Jack Nicholson. Was this, from the very beginning, intended to be a vehicle for him?
Oh, yes, yes. The day that it was finally coming together for me in my mind, Jack was up the street at Quincy Jones's house, and he was playing tennis, and I came up there, and I said, Jack, you know, we're kind of screwed as far as everything is concerned with last detail. What if I write a detective movie? And I was thinking of directing it, and thank God I didn't. Maybe I can tell a good enough story.
You didn't say, let me write the greatest screenplay that's ever been written.
No.
When?
No. I guess you used to start thinking I'm going to write the greatest screenplay ever. And then by the time that I get near the end of the process, I'm thinking, if I don't get roasted alive for this, I'll consider myself very, very lucky. But at the beginning, you always are full of hope.
What was the experience working with Roman Polanski on the film. What was your working relationship like?
Well, Roman and I fought a lot during the day, and then we went out and partied at night.
Came back ready to work the next day.
And fight again.
The ending of the film, the darkness of the ending, not typical for movies to end with something that horrifying as the close. How did you come to that ending?
Well, I had had originally an idea that was in its way just as dark, but it took longer to get to. And I felt at the time that this very dramatic way of getting to it was too melodramatic. So I argued about it. But as I realized over the course of time, that it wasn't. You had to get to it fast. I mean, this movie required, particularly at the time, a great deal of concentration on the part of an audience.
Claudia, I wanted to ask you about some of the things that are difficult for us to watch in the film today. As you said, they're depicting 1937 Los Angeles, not even 1974, but the racial references, physical abuse of women, things like that, that you know we look at very, very differently today. For you, does that intrude at all in how you watch the film?
I think initially, you know, back when I saw it, maybe it didn't, sadly enough. But, yeah, I mean, you know, sort of the racial, the cultural aspersions, the joke he tells about the Chinaman and that kind of thing. We're living in such different times now. And so the reaction, initially you kind of think twice, and it stands out to you. But then, of course, you remember this is the time and the place of this of where this was set. And, yes, the scene with the sister, the daughter, and, you know, I mean, that scene's been done sort of on Saturday Night Live, even, with the back-and-forth thing. But certainly it's not a film that you could probably make the same way now. What do you think, Mr. Tao?
While the response may be slightly shocking today for different reasons, it's true to the time.
Yeah.
And so for that reason, I absolutely am grateful that it's the way that it was, because that's the way that it was.
Sure.
You know, I mean, Jack coming into the Albacore Club place, do you accept anybody of the Jewish persuasion? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, those references were so casual at that time. I remember living in West Hollywood. And there were signs on people's lawns that would say a single for rent, Gentile only, you know, and things like that. So it was there.
Yeah, I was asking sort of how you respond to those references now, Claudia. One thing we've talked about on Film Week is how we watch movies if we have a negative response to someone involved with it. You know, can you watch a Mel Gibson film without feelings about some of the things that he said? Can you watch this film, of which Roman Polanski is a very important part, and not have come to mind his rape of a 13-year-old girl? For me, I feel like, you know, film, there's so many people involved in the making of the movie. I don't reduce it to one person, even as terrible as the action was.
Yeah.
But I feel like I can kind of compartmentalize the art from the individual and the actions of the person who made it. What's your sense of that?
I feel the same way. You know, even when you see him in the film, I mean, he created a piece of art. And so that's what I'm absorbing.
You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC, and we're listening to our panel conversation last Saturday night following the screening of the 1974 classic Chinatown. We'll continue with more right after this.
You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. We're listening to the conversation we had on stage at the Theater at Ace Hotel last Saturday night after our Film Week screening series. We watched Chinatown on the big screen at the Ace Hotel. Joining me after the film, Robert Towne, Oscar-winning screenwriter of Chinatown, and our Film Week critic, Claudia Puig. In the next part of our conversation, I asked Robert Towne about the film's casting.
I wanted to ask you about the chemistry of the stars. John Huston is one of the great screen villains, and the chemistry between the stars is phenomenal. Is that just catching lightning in a bottle? Is that the art of casting? What created
that? I think it's lightning in a bottle. I think one of the great pieces of luck in the casting of that film is Huston, because Huston, with his kind of grandfatherly attitude and everything, is so nicely deceptive. And yet he's able to suggest a malevolence and an evil that is pervasive and I think critical to the success of the film.
What was the biggest challenge in plotting the film? A lot of moving parts here and such elegant ways of getting from one piece of the story to another. Is there one particular challenge that was most vexing as you were writing it?
Getting through it, really. You know, it was such a complicated story that one of the critical things that was important was to reduce it to its simplest elements. It wasn't until the very end where the bifocals that came out, we just decided, oh, wait a minute, maybe one of them didn't have bifocals, and that would be just...
That's how you resolved whose glasses it
was. That was the telling point. But nobody had made up their mind about that until it just finally happened. But, you know, that's the sort of thing that happens when you're working on a movie and it's finally beginning to go well. The pieces start fitting.
And did that solution actually come while you were shooting the film?
Oh, no.
This is all pre-production.
This movie was pretty carefully worked. It was very carefully worked out before it started shooting. There was nothing. Nothing was changed in that movie once we started shooting.
Claudia, you teach at film schools, lecture students about film. This screenplay is often taught as the pinnacle of
the
screenwriting.
Pinnacle, right.
And what are the things that, if you were teaching this to your student, what would you say about it that you think are important for aspiring filmmakers to consider?
Wow. I think, you know, noir films are, there's so many of them. And then to look at something like this, which is a modern-day noir or made more in a modern day, I think is something you capture kind of that Marlowe-esque dialogue, and yet there is... There's some little modernisms that are kind of woven in, but they work. I would tell someone to really scrutinize it carefully. But I did remember hearing that Robert Evans and some of the other Paramount mucky mucks were confused by the script, and I was interested in sort of knowing about that from your perspective.
Well, I was kind of spared the difficulty of dealing with certain executives who didn't understand. Well, listen, Evans said he didn't understand it. So I never worried about that too much, because there were enough people that I knew who I respected who could follow it. You know, I didn't worry about that.
It is such a perfect screenplay. I mean, the dialogues are like pearls. They kind of... they unfold, and you go back, and I found myself like waiting for the lines, and just, you know, the way that they're delivered and everything. There's just, it is, you it was the one Oscar that it did win, and it was so well deserved. It is looked at as just sort of the epitome.
Well, and speaking of the Oscars, that year, 1975 releases Here Are the Five Films Nominated for Best Picture. Lenny, The Conversation, The Towering Inferno. Even with Fred Astaire still. The Godfather Part Two, and Chinatown.
Wow.
An extraordinary year for film, no question. What was it like for you to accept your best screenwriting Oscar?
It was a strange thing, because everybody who worked on the, I mean, there were all these nominations, and none of them were winning. And the screenplay award came near the end of the awards, and so I had the dubious experience of seeing all of my colleagues lose. So by the time that I won, I felt just bad.
The locations are great. The Orange Ranch, by the way, was Walter Brennan's place in Moore Park, where the orange
was
groves
it?
Were.
Yeah, no, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he would, I guess, make extra money, as though he needed it with all his acting, but by renting out his place. So that was the orange grove. And you recognize Rance Howard, Ron Howard's father was the sheep herder guy in LA City Hall.
Right.
Okay.
Chambers, that was him, turns to the camera. That was done at LA City Hall. And of course, the only time the film actually takes you to Chinatown is Ord Street, that very final scene in the film. And that brings me to my final question for you, the title. How'd you arrive at Chinatown, the title being the essence of the film?
As often happens, so much stuff is related to my dog. I bought the dog from a vice cop who was Hungarian. So I was talking to these vice cops, and they had been working in Chinatown. And I said, what do you do there? And they said, well, the truth of the matter is we try to do as little as possible. And I said, that's what the MO is about for working in Chinatown? And they said, well, yeah. I mean, there are so many dialects and so much stuff that's going on that you can't really tell whether you're helping prevent a crime or helping somebody commit one. And so we decided that the best thing to do was do nothing. At least we know we're not inadvertently screwing something up, you know? And so I came to realize that Chinatown came to stand for the futility of good intentions. Mm. I sort of backed into it, you know, I mean, but, you know, that's how that happened.
I hope you've enjoyed listening to our post-screening conversation at the Theater at Ace Hotel last Saturday night, downtown L.A. We watched Chinatown, the 1974 classic, on the big screen. And then we had the honor of speaking with Oscar-winning screenwriter Robert Towne about how he came up with the ideas that were included in Chinatown and wrote such classic dialogue. Claudia Puig, our Film Week critic, also joined us. And I hope you'll be with us for our next Film Week screening series, December, Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown, details to come. Have a wonderful weekend from all of us at Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle.